probably older people and lower income people. Older people because if the House Republicans have their way, insurers will be able to charge them five times as much as they charge young people, compared to three times as much under the Affordable Care Act. And that will quickly subsume the larger tax credit that they can get of up to the $4,000 figure. So older people have quite a bit to lose here. Also, younger people who can barely afford these premiums, if they indeed feel a need to get covered, if they're low income, I should say low income people will probably suffer disproportionately under this.
The income-based phase-out of the credit allows the GOP plan to be funded without taxes on employer-provided insurance. What's the history of this tax credit idea?
It's coming from a couple of streams of thought. One is that Republicans want to build a fence around entitlements. And so Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are the big entitlements that are with spending that's very difficult to control. And so if by putting a limit around either a tax credit as an entitlement or on the Medicaid side also, as a, build a fence around that and limit the escalating spending, then that's a good in itself for fiscal conservatives. Also, the idea of a tax credit, there's a certain semantic quality to this, and that is to say there are a lot of Republicans who like the idea of incentivizing people with a credit, call it a carrot if you like, rather than a stick such as in the individual mandate was. In the end, the tax code, the math looks pretty similar, right? Whether you're getting a tax credit, which is money not in the door for the U.S. Treasury, or whether it's a fine, it doesn't really matter.
But the fine would go to the insurance companies, not to the federal government under the new plan.
Well, so the insurance, that may be a sweetener for to get the insurance companies on board, because they're still going to be experiencing some regulation in the form of prohibiting refusal to issue based on pre-existings, and also prohibition on lifetime limits. The insurance companies should be anxious about this because they're facing some regulation, but they're not getting the steady flow of new customers the way they were under the early years of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, the knock on the Affordable Care Act was that it didn't actually result in enough healthy people signing up to make the whole system sustainable.
That's right.
Does this?
Well, we're never quite sure. It's very difficult to know for sure who's going to take up what offer. Take-up rates can be notoriously difficult to project. I think it's very likely, though, that a lot of young people will sit it out. They will say to themselves, I'm young, I'm healthy, I don't have a lot of income, I don't have to buy insurance, so I won't. And that will probably lead to adverse selection for insurers, meaning that the sicker people and the older people will sign up. And although they'll be paying higher prices, they'll also be filing a lot of claims. So I guess I see trouble ahead for the insurance industry under this.
What about the penalty itself? You know, if there is the GOP proposal has a provision under which if you allow your coverage to lapse, then when you get into a new insurance plan, you pay a 30% surcharge. And that's intended to replace the tax
right.
penalty.
So think of that maybe as a gentler stick. It's not the harsh fine that you pay to the federal government.
Are there unintended consequences, though? If somebody's coverage is lapsed because of a sudden change in employment or a change in income, right. as is not uncommon for lower income
That's
people,
right.
Isn't that a disincentive to get back into the market?
Well, or it's a disincentive also to move out of a job that you may perceive as dead end. So this, I don't know if you remember back in the early 90s, there was a lot of conversation about what was referred to as job lock. The idea is you don't want to leave your job, even if it's an underperforming job, because you'd lose your health insurance or you couldn't afford COBRA coverage. And so it could very well dampen the fluidity of the labor market, and that's obviously not a good thing.
What does that do over time? If how do you measure that dampening?
Yeah, I'm guessing it will affect lower skilled workers a lot more because they are less mobile. As it is, they would experience more anxiety about what benefits they could expect on their next job. Whereas higher skilled workers, higher pay workers, probably can expect that transition from job to job to be smoother.
This is Sound Ideas. We're talking with Greg Shaw. He's an Illinois Wesleyan University political scientist and expert on healthcare policy. Is this going to play well even with conservatives who've not liked the bureaucratic apparatus needed to verify incomes? They started by preferring age-based support only in this, and now there is an income qualifier.
Right. Well, I guess it depends on which conservatives you're talking about. Some will be happy to be able to brand healthcare reform as a Republican product, and they will move right ahead on that. So, you know, Paul Ryan and the House leadership are on board with this, and the White House, to the extent that reflects any sort of real thinking about healthcare policy, you know, they're on board with this. Fiscal conservatives who want to go after entitlements will not like this. They will look at the subsidy in the form of tax credits and say, a subsidy is a subsidy is a subsidy. Let's not create another entitlement and call it an incentive, call it whatever. It's just another giveaway. So they won't. So I think you'll see a lot of fighting between different stripes of Republicans in the House on this.
And Democrats are going to be opposed.
I assume
most likely.
Democrats will sit this out, both because they don't like the more market oriented direction and the lack of generosity of the law, but also they don't want to see their signature legislation of the Obama administration overturned.
How would you handicap it? Do the real fiscal conservative types, are there enough of them to kill this bill?
In theory, yes, but probably in practice, probably not. On the House side, it's a simple majoritarian institution, and so the margin that the Republicans have there, they can still afford to lose, you know, give or take 25 votes and still be able to pass this thing. I think it's probably pretty straightforward on the House side. On the Senate, it's going to be much more difficult because of the filibuster, and so Democrats will be able to filibuster provisions that are not budget-related, and I presume they will do that vigorously, and so that will be difficult to overcome.
Well, that puts Mitch McConnell in a tough spot because the bill is, as you noted, less generous than the Affordable Care Act in order to appeal to some of those conservatives that the more mainstream Republicans would like to peel off from the Tea Party core.
Right.
But the Democrats are not going to want anything quite so not generous. So where does McConnell position the conference bill?
Well, so I don't know if he imagines, you know, reaching out to some, you know, folks like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and nominally a Democrat but really fairly conservative, reach out and build a coalition to get to 60 in that kind of move, although that seems quite difficult. Alternatively, McConnell signals to the House leadership that they need to focus on reform provisions that are all budget-related so that they can use the Budget Reconciliation Project to sidestep the filibuster. That seems like that latter point strategy seems like a more likely way to go.
You mentioned that the White House was on board with this. Is the White House? I mean, President Trump campaigned on the idea of not diluting health care for those who now have it.
That's right. So it's difficult to know what Trump as president really wants, other than to say that he wants to be able to claim a legislative victory. His language during the campaign, his website, everything that he said was quite vague. And so it's true that he wants to leave entitlements alone, and that will dissatisfy people. So if we start trimming Medicaid or Medicare in a significant way, I think he won't be happy about that. But the rest, this is not a detail-oriented guy. As we all saw last week, you know, he told us about his surprise of learning just how complicated healthcare reform can be. And so I think in the end, he will take whatever Congress will serve up.
So there is rhetorical space for him to
absolutely
get on board.
And that was very much by design.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the early look at the Republican proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare. Is there a meaningful rhetorical distinction in health policy between guaranteed health care and guaranteed access for health care?
I think there is. The idea of telling people that they're free to purchase health care and that they have some kind of government support to do that, if the government support is not really very comprehensive or generous for low-income folks, you know, that's sort of health care coverage in theory. That's, you know, whereas if you give people a viable plan that they can use without fear of very steep cost-sharing mechanisms like co-payments and deductibles and co-insurance, then they're going to use that more. They're going to seek out preventative services in a timely way. They're going to strike up relationships with primary care providers that will be meaningful over time. Whereas if instead you're afraid to actually go visit the doctor or go to the hospital because you're afraid of the personal expenses that you're going to incur, people will be less healthy. We know this. So I think there is a distinction between, you know, actual user-friendly, you know, usable health insurance versus token insurance. This raises one other question, by the way. Under the Affordable Care Act, there is a sort of a 10-point plan, if you will, that all health insurance policies that are sold on state exchanges have to meet. You know, it has to meet basic preventative services. It has to meet emergency services. It has to meet maternity and pediatric services and so forth. There's been discussion about eliminating that plan. And so when President Trump says, let's let Americans buy the insurance policies they want to buy rather than the policies that government tells them to buy, what he's getting at is let's pull the floor out from under the minimum coverage provisions now and let insurers market whatever low-end products they want. That doesn't seem to be the way the House Republicans are going right now. Notably, yesterday's plan still included the idea that all policies that are subsidized through tax breaks will have to adhere to that earlier minimum provision.
Why do you think Republicans are still adhering to that? Is that an effort to provide predictability in the marketplace?
You know, that may be. That could mean a couple things. It may be that's an opening bargaining position for them and that they're willing to jettison that later. Perhaps they realize instead that there could be significant blowback if people look at the new products coming out and they're like Swiss cheese. You know, they have so many gaps of coverage that they're not usable, that it will lead to a lot of people having a lot of horror stories to tell. And that is something that could plague them for years to come, because after they revise this law and call it whatever they're going to call it, they will then own it. And we will call it Trump Care, or we will call it Paul Ryan Care, or whatever, right? So I think maybe they're, as an opening move, they're being cautious.
One of the largest changes made by the ACA is the Medicaid expansion. Millions gained coverage, including, 1.2 million or 960,000, somewhere in there, for the state of Illinois alone?
Yeah, I don't know Illinois' figure, but nationally it's between 10 and 11 million people.
The Republican bill would change Medicaid from an entitlement run federally to a per capita cap on funding to states.
Right.
Depending on enrollment. And in states that expanded Medicaid under the ACA, about 31 states, the government would keep paying for nearly all of the expansion until 2020, with a phase out for new Medicaid enrollees after that. Can states bear the burden?
Well, so this is a point where I think Republicans have struggled mightily, because initially, the Medicaid expansion state map looked an awful lot like the blue-red electoral map. Democratic states went for it immediately. Republican states said that, you know, forget it, they wouldn't take that, because it's to participate in that was to collaborate with the enemy. Through 2014, 2015, 2016, many Republican states began to reconsider. They looked for models that looked like a market-based model to give them political cover that they needed to expand. They also, though, understand that governors and state legislators understand that Medicaid is a huge program. For the average state this year will spend between 19 and 20% of all of its money on Medicaid. It's the most expensive thing they do next to public education. And that it's also somewhat unpredictable. As people get sick, they go to get services, Medicaid pays for it. It's difficult to put a stopper in the end of the pipe in terms of the dollars flowing. So for them to move to something to move away from an entitlement basis for the funding, that is to some sort of a fixed grant, whether it's by against a reference year like 2016, which is what the Republican proposal says, or whether it's a capitation plan, however you do that, it puts states in a difficult position. One analogy to this maybe is to think back to how they handled the welfare reform in 1996. They shifted away from an entitlement basis to a block grant, meaning if the federal dollars ran out before your fiscal year was up, that was it. You were then on relying entirely on state dollars going forward.
And there were lifetime limits,
That's right.
For temporary assistance to needy
families.
That's right.
To contain that. But in exchange for that, states received a lot of autonomy. So to the point where welfare dollars don't actually have to be spent on cash grants anymore. So they can do largely whatever they want with those dollars in an anti-poverty way. I don't hear talk of Medicaid moving that way. That is, I don't hear talk of states taking on a lot more autonomy about how to implement Medicaid.
There is more autonomy for those states that didn't adopt the Medicaid expansion.
That's true, but it also is true that they're financially stressed and under pressure from their organized medical providers, their interest groups, their hospital associations, to go ahead and expand because it's very costly. You know, medical services, there's a certain pay me now or pay me later quality to this. You can either fund this up front and see that people get appropriate care in appropriate venues, or you can pay emergency department bills later on. And state legislators, even in conservative states, get that. They understand that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the GOP proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare with Greg Shaw of Illinois Wesleyan University. We won't know the cost of this proposal for some time. The budget office has yet to work it up and score it. Mm-hmm. But from the decrease in the federal footprint and the increase in the state administrative responsibility, what do you see happening as a trend line for government costs at the federal level?
I think you'll probably see initially more people signing up for insurance on the exchanges and perhaps Medicaid and trying to lock in what they a benefit that they have before this before the ACA goes away. I also, though, see some interesting trends on the cost control side, part of it due to government efforts and part of it due to innovative practices by medical providers themselves to curtail overutilization, that is, people using services that they don't truly need or providers delivering non-therapeutic services. So the way this works is generally through some sort of a bundling effort where Medicare, which has been doing this for years for inpatient services, will tie a certain dollar reimbursement to a certain diagnosis so that medical providers then have the incentive to treat the problem efficiently and effectively and as cheaply as they can, getting to take home the rest of the dollars. And that sort of practice, moving away from a fee-for-service and moving toward a more bundled or pay-for-performance kind of model, is taking off both. It's long been working on the public side, but it's also taking off on the private side. And so I see some cost control happening through those sorts of mechanisms.
Well, are Democrats right that in their rhetoric that this was a slow poison to the whole Medicaid system?
Yes. I don't think Medicaid works as a block grant program. The costs are so huge. The needs are literally life and death. Bear in mind also, most Medicaid dollars, about 70% of Medicaid dollars get spent on nursing home and long-term care situations for the chronically ill and the elderly. They're not being given out to, say, single mothers and their kids in the way that the welfare funds go. That is to say, to the great extent that nursing home providers are organized politically, they're going to speak up on this. And state legislators have to know that. So I'd be surprised a little bit, actually, if we get to Medicaid as a block grant arrangement.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the GOP proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare with Greg Shaw of Illinois Wesleyan University. What about prescription drug costs? That was not something that the ACA handled very successfully.
That's
Is
right.
Is this contemplated in the GOP proposal?
So to put this in a little bit of a context, so of all the dollars we spend on healthcare in this country, prescription drugs make up about 10% of that. So it's not trivial, but it's not like Medicare either, right? It's not like for inpatient services, which are hugely expensive. But the rate of escalation that you've seen in recent years where companies will buy a patent and triple or quadruple or quintuple the price is a political outrage, right? I don't know how much of a stomach the Republican Party has for taking on pharma, the big lobbying group for the pharmaceutical industry. Certainly, they have a sweetheart deal right now of getting to there are effectively no cost controls on that. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that administers those two programs is explicitly forbade to negotiate drug prices based on its purchasing power. However, there are a couple of models already in place that might lead them to it would show us the way to doing that. Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense can negotiate prices, but they're not nearly as big a buyer as the Medicare program is. So there's certainly a mechanism in place to do that, and there's a model in place to do that. But I don't know how much stomach the Republicans have for picking that particular fight.
You are finishing up a second book on healthcare policy. Mm-hmm. Is either major strand of policy proposal out there right now on the right track, in your opinion?
Well, if by one of them, we're talking about the current Republican plan that, again, is not a fully mature plan. It only came out yesterday. It's going to be twisted and turned in all sorts of ways. I don't think so. It continues a heavy reliance on the private insurance industry, which gets Americans and states over a barrel and governments over a barrel to pay prices that are quite high and steeply rising. It also privileges the idea that patients can be made like consumers. That is, how you buy a sweater or a car or a box of macaroni and cheese is akin to how you get your broken arm fixed. And that analogy quickly breaks down under evidence. And so I don't think that's the right strategy to go to try to marketize healthcare, which is implicitly what the Republican plan envisions. So note the enhanced use of healthcare savings accounts. That's a tool to put consumers in a position to have more, as advocates like to say it, skin in the game. That is to experience more of the full cost of services. Evidence says that people are only marginally price sensitive on healthcare purchases, and that trying to treat patients like shoppers is a deeply flawed analogy. I think that's the wrong way to go. If by the other track we're meaning what the Affordable Care Act does, that is relying again fairly heavily on a private insurance industry, it's a $1 trillion-a-year industry, to meet about the needs of about half the population, that is the population that's not on Medicare and Medicaid. I don't love that idea either. You know, it's a highly profitable business. The public sector is in a poor position to limit those expenses. And, you know, if you made me king for a day, that wouldn't be the option either.
Okay. Well, what do you think both are missing then? Where should we be going?
Yeah, I think we should be going in a direction that gets beyond the fetish about consumerism and imagining that patients can be made like shoppers. And I think we should instead think about healthcare as a fundamental right. So that envisions a floor below which people are not allowed to fall. So that means enhanced public health services, you know, maybe delivered at the county or state level in terms of lifestyle and education and preventative care. But it also means ready access to services as people need them, instead of having to fret about whether to, you know, pay the mortgage or pay their doctor bills in any given month. And that means a larger public sector role to play in healthcare delivery.
Greg Shaw is an Illinois Wesleyan University professor of political science. His new book, The Dysfunctional Politics of the Affordable Care Act, is out in May from Prager Press. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.